All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for hour number two of our big two-hour weekend get-together here on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison. Let's jump right into the program with the star of our show, Carol Marx, in conversation with Alexis Madrigal. He is the senior editor of The Atlantic and an award-winning former staff writer for Wired.com. He's going to talk to Carol about his new book titled Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology, published by Dacapo Press.
Now let's talk about solar power. Why didn't the solar house and the solar revolution of the 70s succeed? What did that have to do with?
Interesting. Yeah. You know, in some ways, I think it did better than we thought. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is there were a lot of solar hot water heaters who came around that came around during that time, and these are things that sort of you put a plate, kind of this contraption on your roof, and there's a storage tank up there, and it's kind of a really interesting system. It's kind of been around actually since the early 1900s. And while there aren't very many of those systems here in the U.S., in both the Middle East and increasingly in China, there's tons of them, like millions and millions of them. And so in some ways, the revival of that technology during the 1970s has in fact spread, just not here in the United States, which is kind of sad. It was a technology that we came up with, we invented, we perfected, but it has gone elsewhere. The other reason I think it's been a little bit more successful than we think is that the kinds of homes that were built during the 1950s, right, pretty much right after World War II up into the 1970s, were like almost uniquely inefficient. Like our houses now, even the ones that are built in large tract developments, they're not perfect when it comes to efficiency, but the main problem with them is they're just so big. That's really the big problem. You know, people tend to live in a lot more space now than they used to, and that can be good, but, you know, keeping a 4,000 square foot house, you know, heated and cooled is a big operation. Back then, though, the houses were small, but still really inefficient, and so a lot of what the solar home movement and the 1970s, various 1970s solar movements, was just to make people aware that houses could be much more efficient, and that a lot of what was happening during those kind of early suburbanization years were that people were building houses that were cheap up front but that cost a lot of money to operate over time. And I think that's one of the big things that the 1970s did, was it just made people aware of the operating costs of their house. And if you think about it, it's like people buy a home without any kind of, you know, knowledge about how well it's going to work energy-wise. And it's like buying a car without knowing how many miles per gallon it's going to get. You know, I think if without that kind of information, you know, people just would buy whatever gas guzzler they wanted because they would have no way of computing what their cost might be in the future. And so I think that's been a big change in the last few years. It's just the ability to model houses and computers so that people can know what that mile per gallon rating for a house might be.
And, you know, it seems that everything was invented before, but we always don't think about it. And certainly that's true when it comes to another important source of using energy, and that was the electric cars. And they were really right up there competing with fuel-driven cars, and they had great advantages. So I want to know what those advantages were and why did they lose out to gasoline-powered cars? And do you think that we will eventually see this real resurgence of electric cars? It just seems to be starting now.
Sure. Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I mean, it's one of my favorites from the book. Just that, in, you know, if you would have gone to New York City, like you sat down, you know, in Manhattan somewhere, and looked at the cars that were passing by, of which there weren't very many, you would have seen like about a third of them were electric powered, a third were the kind of engines that we know today, the, you know, internal combustion engine, and a third were actually steam powered. They kind of were like a little locomotive on wheels, and you know, there's two different questions there. You know, I mean, why? How did we get electric cars so early, and why has it taken so long? I mean, in some ways, you know, people thought of, you know, cars as an extension of railroads and of trolley cars and things like that. And so how did you power a trolley car? Well, some of them, or how did you power a train? You had steam, you had electric traction, as they called it at the time. And so people extended that kind of thinking right out onto the road, the open road, without rails. And that extension of thinking meant that there were a lot of backers of electric cars. I mean, for one, they're much cleaner. People, even at the time, you know, there's a speech that a guy named Pedro Salem gave to the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia in like 1895. Where he says, like, imagine if there's, you know, thousands and thousands of cars on the road. Think of all the smoke and the smog that will come. Think of the horrible noise. Because the electric cars were fundamentally quiet and clean. And also much easier to control, actually, particularly given the controls of the time. And he figured, and a lot of people thought this too, I mean, gasoline engines are sort of controlled, series of controlled explosions. And people were like, who's going to want to sit on a controlled explosion, you know?
I love that
right.
picture.
It's funny. I mean, people really, it was not at all obvious, I think, in 1900 that you would have the kind of car that you have now. The interesting thing is what really died when the electric car died in those early years, and we'll talk about what happened in a second, was this idea that you'd have transportation as a service, right? That you could just call up an electric car, because most of the electric cars at the time were taxis. And instead, people said, hey, you know, we're going to actually buy these cars as like an individual product as opposed to something that you got from somebody else. And I think in a lot of ways, that was a tremendous sense of freedom to that for a lot of people. And it was something that would be much more difficult to offer with the electric cars of 1900 because they needed to swap out their batteries quite often. And so you needed a whole different kind of infrastructure, and you kind of needed a service model. You needed people who didn't want to be using the cars every single moment of the day. And so I think that's one big reason, that just like the freedom and autonomy that came from gasoline-powered cars. They allowed you to go farther. They allowed you to go faster. And they also didn't require, huge amounts of, you know, charging stations all over, you know, the Northeast. And I think, you know, there was a recent dust-up with Tesla, which is, you know, kind of the most advanced electric car company right now, where they had a New York Times writer try to drive from, you know, some two points on the Eastern Seaboard. And the car was supposed to be able to make it between these supercharging stations, but in fact was not able to make it. And this huge, you know, row resulted over why that happened and how that happened. And I think, you know, the funny thing for me was just thinking back through history that people, even in, you know, kind of the 1910s and 1905, were trying to do similar kinds of drives and similar kinds of publicity stunts. And sometimes they worked and sometimes they backfired in just the same way. And I just think it's something that makes me believe that if electric cars are going to take off, they're going to take off as part of a service package, as part of a system that helps alleviate some of these problems. Because the main thing is, you know, batteries just don't hold as much energy as gasoline does. And it's difficult to make some of these comparisons, but gasoline is what they just call more energy dense.
But you know what I like so much is the fact that you have a whole chapter which talks about ways to make batteries and things better,
yes,
using software and changing really renewable energy research with something called, I think, photovoltaic cells.
Okay,
so
right.
Is that something that we're close to doing, and can you explain how that, because I think that would be revolutionary.
It's true. So there's a lot of work being done on two things, and they're kind of almost related problems, because it's about coming up with a better material, and it's photovoltaic, so those are the things that people know from roofs. When you see solar panels, those can convert the photons from the sun, light from the sun, directly into electricity. And the related problem is batteries, which are about storing electricity for use at a later time. And the fascinating thing is the ability of a material to convert light to electricity or to hang on to electricity is completely determined almost by the nature of the material, like down at the quantum level, right? Like down at these tiny, almost unimaginably tiny scales, what the material actually looks like. And so what people have been doing for a long time is, you know, they make a little bit of a new material, a tiny little bit, and then they test its properties, and then they make a little bit and they test its properties. And what they're able to do now is to essentially make lots and lots of them in the computer and simulate some of their properties. And that allows them to move much, much, much faster, because the physical reactions of, like, the chemistry when people are sitting at a lab bench, like in a white coat, are actually kind of slow relative to being able to run something on a supercomputer. And so that provides a lot of hope, I think, for green technology, because that kind of material science has just really been starting to get going in the last couple of decades. And really, specifically in the last, say, 5 years is when you've seen people able to do a lot of these simulations, just because the computers finally got good enough to do a lot of them.
So maybe that's going to be in our future.
I think we're close. Yeah. I think that, you know, you'll see, like, in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years, there's going to be whole classes of new materials come out that allow people to do things that they never thought they could before.
Alexis Madrigal, in conversation with Carol Marx. His book is titled Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology, published by DeCapo Press. For more information, go to earth2tech.com. Two is the numeral, earth2tech.com. A Touch of Gray continues in a moment.
There are a ton of social networking websites, but one stands apart for a very special reason. This one saves lives. It's MatchingDonors.com. MatchingDonors.com links organ donors with people in need of kidney and other transplants. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. If you've ever considered becoming a living organ donor, or if you're someone in need of an organ transplant, visit MatchingDonors.com, home of the greatest gift of all, the gift of life, MatchingDonors.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, here's Carol Marx in conversation with Richard Hill, author of Finding Family, My Search for Roots and the Secrets in My DNA.
Now, I love how your book begins. All families have secrets, some bigger than others. My family's secret leaked out in 1964. So can you tell us about your family's secret?
Well, basically what happened is in 1964, I was 18 years old. And I was just about getting ready to go to college, and I started having these strange pains in my chest at night. So I wanted to get that fixed before I went away to school, and my family doctor had retired. So I made an appointment with the doctor that had my files now. And he quickly diagnosed my problem as just basically acid reflux. And he was trying to figure out why I was producing so much acid. And he thought maybe it was stress of some kind, and he started asking me questions about whether I felt pressure to do well in school and things like that, and I said no. And then finally he started looking through my file, and he came up with one more question. He said, how do you feel about being adopted?
Wow.
And I couldn't answer that because until that moment I didn't know I was adopted.
So that was quite an awakening. Now, what did you do next? Did you go home and ask your parents about being adopted?
Well, it happened that that appointment was in the middle of the day, and I was working my summer job, and I had quite a few hours before I went home. So I started mulling this over in my mind, and I kind of decided that, well, first of all, it didn't really make much difference to me. I mean, these were the only parents I ever knew. I loved them, and they loved me, and I think the timing had a lot to do with it, because I was just literally days away from moving away and going away to college. So I was very, very focused on my future, and because of that, the past just didn't seem all that, you know, important. Plus, I knew my parents were already upset. I was an only child, and they were kind of upset about me moving off to, you know, leaving home and going to college. So I thought, well, I'm going to bring this up now. I'll wait, and maybe they'll bring it up later, you know. And so I didn't say anything to them.
And that's what happened. Your dad did bring it up later after he had a stroke. And before he died, he told you some important things about your biological mother. What did he say, and how did that change your preconceived notions about adoption?
Well, this was 14 years later, and as you said, he had had a stroke, and he was hospitalized for a long time before he died. And this was just a few weeks before he finally did pass away, and I was visiting him as I did several times a week, and he just suddenly out of the blue brought up the subject of my adoptions and started talking about it. And I had always assumed that it was just an anonymous, event, and that my parents didn't really know anything about my original family. And I was really wrong, because apparently my birth mother was related to a friend of theirs, and she was from the Detroit, Michigan area, and my parents were living in Lansing at the time. And so back then, when a girl got pregnant, she left town quietly, and in this case, she left town and came up and actually lived with my adoptive parents in their apartment for the last 5 months of her pregnancy. And the other big thing was that I had assumed that she was probably just some young girl, high school age or something, and this was her first pregnancy. And my dad told me, no, that wasn't the case. She was actually older. It turns out she was like 20 when I was born, and she had been married and divorced, and that she had a child already. So I had a brother, and that was what my dad wanted to share with me before he died.
Now, let's talk about the almost 30 years it took you to research and find the information you needed to reconnect with the living members of your biological family. Do you think you would have had an easier time doing the investigation if the adoptee right laws in this country were different? So how do they need to be changed?
Well, yeah, that was a big problem. I spent a long time, years and years, trying to go from nothing because I didn't have access to the files. Adoptees are the only class of citizens in the U.S. who were just denied a basic human right. We are not allowed to see our original birth certificates. And if I had been able to get that information right away, it would have taken some time off my search, number one. But on the other hand, as it turned out, it would still not have gotten me to the final answer because once I did get access to that information, of course, by then I'd already found out through other means who my birth mother was, and she had already died, so I was never able to meet her. But I finally found the name of the man she had said was my birth father and used that information to track him down, and he was very glad to hear from me and was hoping that I was his son because he'd never had children. But we took a DNA paternity test, and it proved that he was not my father. So in this case, even the records, at least on the father's side, were wrong.
And DNA tests certainly played a role in your adoption search. And isn't there really great news in both the number of genetic tests that are now available and their improved accuracy? And you did mention one particular DNA test that you thought was very helpful for men, the Y-DNA test. So why is that a good thing to have if you're a male looking for biological parents or relatives?
Well, the Y-DNA test, which, by the way, I took through a company called Family Tree DNA, and they are clearly the one to use because they've got the biggest database. They have over 300,000 men in their Y-DNA database. And the Y chromosome, it only exists in men, and it passes down pretty much unchanged from our father, and he got it from his father, and so on. It just tracks what they call the paternal line. And if a man takes this test and comes up with one or more close matches from other men in the database, that means that you and that other man have a common ancestor in your paternal lines. Now, the big breakthrough that I figured out for adoptees is that in our culture, at least in, there's some recent exceptions, of course, but for centuries, the last name has followed the paternal line. So, a man gives his son his last name, and then he gives his son his last name. So what I came up with was that by checking my match and seeing what his last name was, there was a good chance that my biological father had the same last name. And in my case, that turned out to be exactly true.
Now, you have done something that's very helpful because there are a number of genetic tests. You have a free 12-page DNA testing guide on your website, DNAtestingAdvisor.com. So can you tell us a little bit about what's on your website and what's in the guide?
Okay, well, once I had this success of finding my biological family through the DNA testing, I wanted to help people understand this, particularly adoptees. But then I also found out that a lot of genealogists who are just tracing their family trees don't understand this new science, which is actually referred to as genetic genealogy, because there are, you know, other tests besides the Y-DNA test. There's a test that tracks the maternal line, and then there are new, what they call autosomal tests, that will find you people who have common ancestors with you from any branch of your family tree. And so I started creating this website, which I call DNAtestingAdvisor.com, as a way of telling people what I found out and explaining the different DNA tests and their options. And then along the way, I decided that, you know, having to go page by page through a website can be very informative, and a lot of people find it that way, but there was no real concise, up-to-date overview of DNA testing, so I created a little DNA testing guide, which is just a 12-page document, and it's a PDF file that people can read on any computer that has a reader. And I put that on the site, and basically people can go and get it and follow the instructions and download it to their computers.
You know, and that is so great and so helpful. What did you find out about your biological family and yourself as a result of your extensive search?
Well, of course, big thing is I found actual new family members. You know, I now that I've completed the search, I have a new half-brother, a new half-sister that's on my father's side. And then 30 years ago when I did the search for my birth mother and identified her, I did find the missing brother, the brother that my father had told me about. And so I found a half-brother on my mother's side, and he and I now have been brothers for 30 years. And this is just great because, you know, I think we're now as close as any brothers would be. And that takes, you know, years to develop, but when you're an only child, it's really cool to discover a brother late in life. And now I have a new brother and a new sister.
That's Richard Hill in conversation with Carol Marks. The book is titled Finding Family, My Search for Roots and the Secrets in My DNA, published by Create Space. The website, DNA-testing-advisor.com. A Touch of Gray continues in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray.
Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we come to the final half hour of our big two-hour weekend get-together, when we're joined by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. In just a moment from now, Richard Neer is going to be in conversation with Glenn Frankel, the Pulitzer Prize winner and the author of The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend, published by Bloomsbury. The Searchers, Richard, what is that? That's an old movie?
Well, The Searchers was voted by the American Film Institute the best Western, no relation to the hotel chain, ever made. It starred John Wayne as Ethan. He was a guy that hated the Comanche, he called them, through the whole movie. And what happened, Natalie Wood was a little girl, and she was kidnapped by Indians and made into a squaw. She was husbanded by an Indian. John Wayne was so prejudiced toward Indians that rather than find her and save her, he wanted to find her and kill her because she had been debauched by the red man.
Oh, my gosh. When you think about some of the things that happened in Hollywood, in Hollywood's depiction of history and Hollywood's depiction of ethnicities and various minorities, it really is kind of... somewhere between terribly frightening and laughable, isn't it?
Well, but in this movie, they actually showed some sympathy for the Native Americans and showed John Wayne to really be an unreconstituted bigot. So I think a lot of it depended subjectively on how you viewed it, but I think it did show both sides.
I don't remember the movie, I hate to say, and you know me, I'm a fan of old movies, I guess they change every year what they consider to be the greatest movies of all time, depending upon current view. I thought the Western Shane was considered the greatest Western of all time. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, absolutely, with Alan Ladd.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, we're going to hear your conversation with Glenn Frankel coming up next. And then let's talk a little bit about those old movies and those old Westerns with our own take when we come back after that. So coming up next, Richard Neer in conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Glenn Frankel. When A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison. Here, as promised, is Richard Neer in conversation with Pulitzer Prize winner Glenn Frankel, author of The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend.
And Glenn has done an exhaustive amount of research in this book, and he goes to the original story, a true story, which happened in May of 1836, where Comanches kidnapped a 9-year-old girl. And it is sort of what the movie is loosely based on. Alan LeMay wrote the novel in 1954, I guess. And Glenn, tell us about the actual story and how it differs from what eventually became the motion picture, The Searchers.
Well, as you pointed out, her name was Cynthia Ann Parker. She was 9 years old. She was part of a large extended family that had settled in East Texas. In a fortified settlement with a fort and walls and gates. They happened to leave the gates open because they were doing last-minute planting, and a large group of Comanches and Kiowa came down
raided them, killed five people, killed five men, and kidnapped five young people, including Cynthia Ann. And she spent 24 years with the Comanches, married a Comanche warrior, had three children, and then was recaptured by Texas Rangers and U.S. Cavalry in 1860 in a raid that they staged against the Comanche encampment. So some of this sounds like the Searchers, an original raid on a family, people killed, a little girl taken off, and then recaptured, though in the book, The Searchers, and the film, it's about a 7-year time period between the two events. And, of course, the young girl who's about 9 when she's kidnapped, it does grow into a young woman and becomes the wife of a Comanche warrior, but she doesn't have children yet. A lot of things have changed. The big change, of course, between the original story and the novel and film is that the focus changes from being about the little girl herself and her life and what happened to her, to turning the lens to the family searching for her uncle and adopted brother, fictional character, spending 7 years trying to track her down and bring her back. And that's the biggest change of all, I would say. And in the movie, of course, the uncle, played by John Wayne, really becomes the dominant figure.
And there are even differences in the book than in the movie, because in the book, the John Wayne character dies, and in the movie, you see that beautiful, iconic shot of him through the tunnel, where you see him walking off basically into the sunset, so to speak.
Yes, that's very much the case. In the book, it's the adopted fictional brother, who's called Martin Pauley, who really is the focus of the book in many ways, and his evolution from a callow youth to a very experienced, hunter and moral center of the story. In the movie, of course, you've got John Wayne, and John Wayne dominates any screen he's on, and the screenplay was written very much with him in mind. So, for example, the book begins with a family in a ranch house fearing that Comanches are about to raid them. It's a very dramatic opening, and it works very well. But the movie begins with John Wayne's character riding up to this ranch house earlier in the story. And again, that's simply because you've got this incredibly charismatic movie star dominating the proceedings. And as you say, he doesn't die. It's really hard to kill John Wayne. It's a very rare movie where John Wayne actually died. But I would argue that in some ways, while he's triumphant in returning and in finding this niece and bringing her home, that in some ways he's defeated in the movie. If you remember, one of the things that's so important in the movie and so makes it such a tense and dramatic narrative is the uncle is not planning to rescue his niece to restore her to the family. She's grown into a young woman. She's married a Comanche. She's in effect become, in his mind, polluted somehow, racially and sexually even, and he's planning to kill her. It's an honor killing, in other words. And to complete his vengeance, if you will. And the question we're always wondering in the film is, what's going to happen? Is he going to do this terrible thing? Or is he going, in the end, to surrender to greater forces than that? Is hatred going to triumph, in other words, or is love going to triumph? And that's what makes the movie, I think, such a really interesting and rich subject.
And the interesting thing, too, it's been condemned by some as being racist. Others say, oh, it's exactly the opposite. And it seems that the director, John Ford, intentionally put that ambivalence, every decision he had to make, he kind of left it up to the viewer to decide as opposed to making a black and white statement, no?
That's exactly right. One of the things you notice when you read the shooting script, the final shooting script, and then you compare it to the movie itself, is that, as you say, there are a number of places there where Ford eliminates, deletes, dialogue or exposition where people explain why they're doing things, and he makes you decide. He tells his story visually, and he leaves enough ambiguity that you've got to decide why the uncle makes the choices he makes. Is he really planning to kill her? When does he decide that? And why does he decide to do what he does at the end of the film? I think these are the things that really raise this film from just a very good, John Wayne movie to something very, very special, because it really does engage the viewer, and it's not simple. John Ford can whether it's a racist film or it's a film about racism, you could almost make the case it's both, but the fact is John Ford has this wonderful double vision, if you will, this ability to both give you the myth and then to undercut the myth and give you something deeper.
And another interesting thing about the actual filmmaking of it is he liked early takes. He didn't want the over and over and over and over again. He wanted the first or second take whenever he could. And I think he also encouraged a little bit of improvisation, a little bit of experimentation with the actors, no?
Yes, he did. I think in the morning he would get there and they would work some things out and then they would do them. And, you know, I'd say he had basically two motives for doing things quickly and for only doing a couple of takes. First of all, he didn't want the actors acting. He wanted them to be natural. He wanted the first thing from them. He wanted them to treat it as if they were these people. And he always felt he got that early and that the more times they'd have to do it over again, the more artificial it would become. But the other thing was control. By only printing one or two takes, he didn't leave much for the editor. He didn't leave anything for the studio to say, well, let's do it this way. John Ford, among other things, really wanted control of everything in his movie, from the casting to the script, you know, to the shoot, to the cut, and to the final cut. And by not leaving the studio anything to play around with, he guaranteed that it was his from beginning to end.
And it was interesting that he was abusive and bullying to John Wayne. I mean, we think of John Wayne as this larger-than-life character who nobody could push around, and yet John Ford did.
We're talking about two larger-than-life characters here. They had a wonderful relationship that went back to when Ford was a director early on at Fox, and Wayne walks in. He's going to the University of Southern California, and Ford hires him to do some hired hand stuff, you know, to help design, you know, carpentry work and things like that. John Ford was abusive, if you will, to everyone that he loved and to everyone who loved him. And the level of abuse in some ways marked how much affection he had. It just was the way he related to the world. Wayne was a very loyal person. Ford made Wayne a star, essentially, in 1939 by casting him in Stagecoach. Of course, Wayne was really, really good in Stagecoach, so it wasn't just Ford's magic. It was Wayne's persona and the character that he was developing. And they went on to make something like 14 movies together. Ford always beat up on Wayne, if you will. He always had nasty things to say. But at the same time, he always admired Wayne, and Wayne respected him and really felt that people like Ford and also the other great director, Howard Hawks, really brought out things in Wayne and really challenged him in ways that other directors did not. So, yes, it was abusive, but at the same time, Wayne realized he got a lot out of the relationship.
Yeah, and Wayne seemed constantly trying to prove to Ford that he was actually an actor, not just a screen personality, you know, that he could act. And the interesting thing is you posit in the book that the most modern movie that is like The Searchers might be Taxi Driver. Explain how those two might be related.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Taxi Driver takes place in New York, but it's about an outsider, a loner, a psychopathic one played by Robert De Niro, and he meets this young girl who is, you know, played by Jodie Foster, who's involved in this terrible trade, if you will. She's been turned into a prostitute, and he decides he's going to rescue her. And he does this in an act of terrible violence. And so this moving from one world to another, you know, from De Niro's twisted world to the world that Jodie Foster's occupying, and his invasion of that and his search to find her and then bring her back is sort of, if you will, a twisted version through the mirror of Searchers. Paul Schrader wrote the screenplay. He's well aware of the Searchers. He's written other screenplays. Hardcore is another film that Paul Schrader was involved in that also has a similar theme. In some ways, he's been remaking Searchers through his whole career. and Martin Scorsese saw the Searchers when he was something like 13 years old. He's talked about what an amazing experience it was for him, both for him and Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, all of whom saw it in a formative time in their lives. The Searchers became sort of the model of what a great, powerful, visually beautiful, but emotionally powerful movie was all about. And I would argue all three of them have taken bits from it, have modeled their own work after it to a great extent, you know, ever since they saw it.
That's Glenn Frankel in conversation with Richard Neer. The book is titled The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend, published by Bloomsbury. I'm Michael Harrison. Coming up next, some final words in our final segment of this two-hour get-together with Richard Neer on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You're age 65, and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of our big two-hour weekend get-together and some more conversation with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Richard, excellent conversation with Glenn Frankel. And I was thinking during your discussion with him just how much I personally and so many people who love movies will miss the late, great Roger Ebert. Just a absolute default go-to guy. When you want to know about a movie and have an idea of whether it was the kind of thing you'd want to see or not, or just how good it is. What a bright man. What a wonderful critic.
You know, he was, and in reading the obituaries all week, usually when a public figure, especially somebody who's been in the public eye for so long, passes, there's usually a little bit of, well, I never liked the guy, or he wasn't so good. I never saw that with Roger Ebert. Everything I read spoke of him in glowing terms, not just as a critic, but as a human being. And a man who, as most people know, had battled thyroid cancer, for the last 10 years of his life. And yet, right up until the day he died, was still communicating through a computer and still reviewing films and still just really... living a very, very vibrant life right up until the end.
The news story just a day or two before he died was that he was going to back off working as hard because he just wasn't feeling as good anymore. So he actually worked right to the very end. And on that level alone is an inspiration to the human condition and to the human spirit. The movies from the old days to the present, since we were talking about the Searchers, and I displayed a lapse of memory in terms of personally not recalling it, even though at this point I'm quite aware of what it was and what it is. Boy, oh boy, have movies changed during the course of our lifetime. So much so that watching an old film, especially a black and white one or one of the early color films from today's perspective, one you haven't seen in a while, one you grew up with, can just be an absolutely culturally jolting experience. Do you find that?
Well, in a lot of ways, but it's funny. When I was very young watching some of these old movies, I didn't think they were, you know, people were very intelligent back then. I thought they glossed over a lot of things. And yet, you know, if you watch them today with your slightly elder eye, you see a lot of subtleties in those movies. You know, when they talk about sex or when they talk about violent acts and things, things that in today's movies are much more visceral and you see plainly depicted on the screen. Back then, they gave you little hints. And if you were a kid watching the movie, you probably didn't pick up on it. But you watch it now, there's a lot of stuff there that didn't meet the eye back then.
I think you're right. And I have noticed that they were not as cardboard or cartoon-like as we might have thought along the road to developing to our present age. I've had different views of these things also because the people are different ages compared to us. When I was a kid watching those movies, I thought that they were old people in these movies. Then going back and watching them, I thought they were contemporaries. And then now looking at them, people that I thought were old are now young. and that alone is enough to really warp or alter, or well, for a better term, update your take on it all. Richard, excellent job. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to you joining us again right here next weekend. Ladies and gentlemen, our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, thank you. Thank you, Beverly Santinella, on the front line. Thank you, Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program, Steve Wiseman, Kevin Casey, the entire Touch of Grey broadcast team. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.